Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Okay, welcome back. And joining us now, as we said, we have the one and only Mark Saffrick. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, Alan. I appreciate it. I look forward to educating your listeners.
Now, Mark, this is the first time you've been on our show, so let's give a little bit of history of who you are and what you have been doing in the criminal world.
Well, I started my career as a police officer in California, made detective and worked in violent crimes, and it was really as I was working homicide cases that I went to a homicide school, and there were a couple of FBI profilers that were giving us a lecture in the early 80s, and I became fascinated, absolutely fascinated with this particular way of looking at complex homicides, and I decided to try to apply that to the cases I was working on, and that began my involvement with the FBI's Behavioral Sciences Unit, and it eventually led me to apply to the FBI as a special agent. I got in. I traveled around the country in different locations. My first one was I worked the Indian Reservation in Wyoming. Worked all the violent crimes there. Then went to New York and then to Sacramento. And then I applied to when openings finally came up in the Behavioral Analysis Unit, I applied and was accepted, which is where I had always wanted to be. So I spent the first 11 years of my FBI career working the streets, and then the last almost 13 years as a profiler, criminal profiler in the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit before I retired after 23 years. And then I joined Bob Ressler, who was one of the icons in this whole field, one of the guys who originally started it and coined the term serial killer back in the 70s. And I took over his business, Forensic Behavioral Services, which I have now been president of for over 12 years now, doing the same kind of work essentially that I did in the unit. I mean, I've branched out. I do a lot of media work, television, single episodes and series and research and publishing. And so I try to keep my finger in a lot of little pies.
You know, what do you think the biggest misconception is in the public when it comes to behavioral analysis?
I think the biggest misconception, because people talk about the term profiling, criminal profiling, and it's really one of the assessment tools that we use under the umbrella of criminal investigative analysis. And I've had a number of people who said, "Are you profiling me?" And I don't really profile people. I'm not assessing someone. I'm assessing behavior. Because generally, from a law enforcement perspective, and that's, of course, what the FBI is, a law enforcement agency working, and as a criminal profiler, you're working on other law enforcement agencies' complex serial murder cases or sexual homicides or serial sexual assaults. You are assessing behavior because generally we don't have the offender. We have a crime and we have a crime scene. So it's really looking at these complex cases from a multidisciplinary approach. Criminal profiling is really, I think, from what most people think of it, and I think a lot of that is framed through their reference in television shows that have appeared over the years, that, you know, we are looking at the killer, assessing the killer, but really we never have the killer for the most part. We only have what the killer leaves behind or what the rapist leaves behind. Their behavior, the physical evidence, the forensic evidence, that whole dynamic totality of the circumstances of particular types of crimes. And from that, we then extract information, induce information, deduce information to come up with sort of a composite of an individual. That would be criminal profiling, but there are a number of other aspects that we can be involved with law enforcement agencies, from helping craft search warrants to investigative considerations to expert testimony work in cases which I have done a lot of. Generally, I would say that all of this comes from crime scene analysis. You have to understand the dynamics of what's happening in these cases. And I think it's important to understand, for people to understand, that most violent crimes really are not amenable to being behaviorally assessed because there's simply not enough behavior. So the types of crimes that we would get involved in, or the cases that I get involved in, are much more complex, where you have multiple victims or multiple offenders, or you have a significant period of time that the two spend together, and a lot of aberrant behavior or excessive violence. When you have what we would describe as psychopathology within the crime that's extensive, that is really the realm within which we work. But I think the general public gets skewed about profiling, and it's just profiling the killer, looking at the killer and assessing them, and it's really not, that's really not the process.
Have you noticed a big change in these killers and serial killers nowadays as compared to what they were in the 60s and 70s?
I think with the advent of the advances in forensic technology, I've noticed, not in all killers and probably in very few, but there are some of the more organized, intelligent offenders who will take into account the forensic advances that have been made. So they're more aware of leaving particular types of forensic evidence. I remember working a serial case of a young man who was raping and murdering elderly females and was actually removing the fingernails of these women. I think he thought that, you know, in the struggle when they would scratch him, that he was leaving DNA under their fingernails, so he was making a conscious effort to have that, you know, forensic evidence taken away. So I think there are some cases where, you know, they're more conscious, but a lot of what drives, you know, especially serial offenders is, you know, need-driven behavior, what we would really describe as ritualistic behavior. And that behavior really has to be engaged in by these offenders. It's part of the crime for them, but oftentimes it's it can also be detrimental in terms of the fact that it causes them or forces them to leave, you know, more evidence than they normally would.
So now the series Mindhunter has been pretty popular in the public. What's your feeling on that? Is it a good thing?
You know, there's been a lot of shifts over the decades. I think people sometimes get concerned that we're, you know, all of these television shows, whether they're true crime or, you know, odes to true crime, are instructing offenders. And maybe to a small extent they are, but you know, you have to, especially in television, you have to combine aspects of reality and factual, the factual nature of forensic evidence with the need to entertain people. So I think Mindhunter is doing that. I think that they've flipped the roles. I mean, I know that they've flipped the roles of the two primary individuals in this. My partner is actually one of those individuals, but he actually had the larger role. He was the one organizing and taking the research forward, but he's treated in the series as the one who's really not interested. And so factually, nobody really would know that unless you were, you know, had been involved in the FBI's behavioral unit. But, I mean, overall, I think they've tried to recreate the killers that they're interviewing and sort of the dynamics of how this process started, you know, to make it in both factual and entertaining at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked to Ann Burgess as well, and she said pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. I know Ann very well, so yeah. I mean, they're taking quite a few liberties with this, with the show. So.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
But I think, I mean, you have to do that, whether it's Criminal Minds or it's CSI Las Vegas, which I consulted for about 8 or 9 years. You know, you have to take I know from that show at least, you know, they were trying to be accurate, forensically accurate and process-wise accurate, but of course you're also doing a show, you're trying to entertain people in a very short period of time. So, you know, time frames get crunched and you know, there's a lot of liberties taken, you know, because if you tried to show the reality, especially like of what I do, it would be mind-numbingly boring, right? So you have to make it entertaining for people.
So now you've moved on to, or moved on, but you've added to your repertoire. You've written a book, and it's called Spree Killers. What was the cause of that? Like, why did you write that?
I was up in Pennsylvania getting ready to lecture for my co-author, Dr. Catherine Ramblin. And we were having dinner one night, and this was about a year and a half ago, and we were discussing a case that had happened, got a lot of national attention, the Dwight Lamont Jones case in Arizona. And we recognized that, in discussing the case, that law enforcement had actually been in a position to proactively intercept Jones before he was able to kill more of the victims that he had on his list. And we thought that was an interesting dynamic, one, for two reasons. One is that this was really a spree killing. And spree killings really have not gotten very much interest through the academic and research world. But also, you know, quite opposite to what you find in serial and mass murders, which typically law enforcement is in a reactive mode to those cases. They're always responding to the case. With certain, well, we didn't know it at the time, but we knew at least with the Jones case that that type of case, law enforcement could be proactive and actually identify or potentially identify the offender to capture them or stop them and potentially future victims. So we decided initially that we thought we could write a paper about this. We could start to collect spree murder cases. We would define it and then collect these cases, then try to organize them into some categories, which actually has never been done. So our book is the first real attempt to do this. By the time we reached about 128 cases, we realized there were many more cases that we could collect, not only here but internationally, which we wanted to do, and that this was a bigger project than just an article. And we decided that we would then continue with the research and do a book on it. And as we went along and collecting our cases and analyzing them and breaking down the interesting or important components, at least as we saw them, our categories that we initially set up started to change and shift. The more cases we got, the more types of killers that we were able to identify, we were able to refine our categories. So it became very interesting. And we ended up, I think when we finally cut off our research, we were at 419 killers, which is really the largest database of pure spree killers in the world. There have been a number of publications, books and such that have been written with spree killer in the title or focusing on spree killers. And I read them all in preparation for this book. And what I really learned was that not one of those books had a pure spree killer collection of cases. There was a mixture of some mass murder cases, a lot of serial cases, and spree cases, all being referred to as spree murder cases. And in some of the books, despite the fact that they were really talking about spree murder, they never defined it. There was no definition anywhere in the book about what a spree murder really was. So it was really clear to us that we would clearly define it, clearly identify categories based on our analysis. And then we were able to put all of our killers into these different categories.
Why do you think there has been no interest or no real books out on it in the academy?
Well, I think what happens is you've got, you know, serial murder and mass murder are well researched, well written about, as we all know, and spree murder sort of falls in between those. It shares initially it's from the initial definitions, it would share components with serial and components with mass. And even in our categories, some of our categories shift. When you shift spree murder closer to serial, you know, you see certain components in the cases that resemble serial murder, a longer time frame. But you have spree cases that also can shift close to, on this continuum, close to mass murder. And we developed a category to capture that we call movement in tight locations. And I think most researchers basically would try to shoehorn spree killers really into either the mass category or into the serial category. The FBI did define spree murder, but, you know, it was an attempt that in some cases overlapped serial and other cases overlapped mass. And I think that's, you know, that's where we were going with this. The FBI was trying to get delineations between these categories that made sense. And what happened was in 2005, Actually, my unit, the adult crimes unit in the profiling unit, we decided that because there was so much discussion about serial murder and how it should be defined and categorized and what should we use time frames or number of victims or motives for these offenders, we decided to pull together experts from around the world to discuss this phenomenon and to redefine it, because a lot of people weren't happy with the FBI's definition of serial murder. And in the book, we go into this, and I go into the whole history of how this process came about. But the end result is that when we eventually did decide, when we defined serial murder, one of the key components that differentiated serial murder from spree murder was this, well, quote, cooling off period, or this this temporal piece or time piece that separated the murders and serial murder. When that part of the definition was eliminated, because the current definition really is the unlawful killing of two or more victims by the same offender in separate events. And we used to have this cooling off period in there, but when we removed that, it basically made the definition of serial murder the same as spree murder. So our argument was, the symposium attendees said, well, let's eliminate spree because, now there's no difference between that and serial. And you basically subsume all the spree cases or most of them into serial. But our argument was that spree is a valid category. There are types of multicides, this multicide of spree, that clearly is different than serial and clearly different than mass murder, and that it has a usefulness to law enforcement when they're investigating these cases. And that's really, what prompted Catherine and I to move forward with this. But there's really never been a lot of research in spree murders. I think, serial murder and mass murders, garnered the headlines. We talk about spree murders in the media, but not very much research has ever been done on those cases. And this is really, I think, one of the first sort of seminal works on spree murder. And we have a lot of cases, and every one of them is summarized in the book and how we categorize it. And I think it's a pretty worthwhile database in terms of how we were able to, come up with these categories that actually all of our cases fit into.
What exactly is it that, or what would you describe are the main characteristics of a spree killer as opposed to serial
right
killer?
So the definition we have of spree killing, one of the early we didn't think two victims was too close to the serial murder definition. We needed to have a definition that sort of exemplified, as Reinhard put it in some early research, chain killing. And so Catherine and I thought about this very carefully because definitions are very important. We didn't want to go too far afield and change up everything, but we want.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I wanted to just take the SPREE definition that existed and basically tune it up. So the way that we've defined it is at least three murders in at least two locations arising from a key precipitating incident that continues to fuel the need to kill, and that these murders occur fairly close in time. And we recognized that, you know, when you say fairly close, you know, well, fairly close to one person can mean one thing and to somebody else can mean something different. But it's at least three murders in at least two locations where the first murder sort of, what precipitates the first murder fuels the rest of the murders. And our time frames, and that's why we have categories that, and some get closer to serial where those time frames are spread out more in terms of weeks. And then we have others that move, like the movement in tight locations, which generally moves closer to mass murder, where the time frame may be hours or, you know, a day or a much shorter time frame. So that's how we defined SPREE, and we also discussed our use of the term fairly close in time, because if you make it so defined that we didn't want cases to be excluded that we really felt were SPREE cases. So we used this term fairly close in time, but in each of the categories, we define that. What defines the category, and so we're pretty clear about that.
Do you think that the policing and police agencies get enough
training in this area? No, not at all. I mean, I know I've been through a lot of training, of course, especially within serial murder, sexual homicide, mass murder, but there's almost no training on SPREE killers. And I think that is one of the premises that we're really trying to get out to law enforcement. That is, if you can recognize that you have a SPREE killer, there are things you can do to become proactive if you have the right category. And I just don't think law enforcement gets that kind of training, you know, about this type of multicide. We get training, and I do it myself. I lecture a lot on sexual homicide, on serial murder, and on mass murder. But the actual training on SPREE killers, and this is borne out by the paucity of research that is out there on this type of multicide. I think law enforcement would benefit greatly especially violent crime investigators, homicide investigators, to understand sprees, how they're defined and categorized, and then when they get those kind of cases, to then be thinking about, you know, is this the type of category, do our cases fall into a category that where we can be proactive, or do they fall into another type of category where we can't be? Because if we can't be proactive, then we just have to go back to good old, you know, our police work, you know, boots on the ground, you know, forensic work to solve these cases. But if you recognize you may have a different category that you may be able to work with proactively, then you can, you know, move forward in that direction and hopefully save lives and or, you know, intercept the offender.
When I think of spree killing, I think of Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate, as well as John Allen Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo. Those are some famous cases. Is sure. there anything more obscure that you think might interest our listeners?
Well, I think there's cases that we tend to think of as perhaps of serial killers like Andrew Cunanan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think if you ask most people, law enforcement people or researchers, criminologists, they would probably put Cunanan in the category of serial killer. But actually, you know, he kills, although the time frame is quite long, and he's one of the longest in our research, he is killing over that time frame, and he is on the move the whole time. So he really is, by our definitions, a spree killer. And then you take someone like Anders Breivik, very well-known killer in Norway. And I think most people think of Breivik as a mass murderer, which he is. There's no doubt that he's a mass murderer. But I think most people don't know that Breivik, you know, set a bomb off in Oslo, Norway, that killed 8 people. And the purpose of the bomb was to draw law enforcement to him, to that location, so that he could then move to the island of Utøya, where he killed 69 children. You know, most people, when you talk about Anders Breivik, you would say he's a mass murderer, and that's the thing, right? So it gets confusing, you know, because he did commit mass murder, but when you take all of his homicides together, he really is a spree killer.
So it was part of a spree, yeah.
It's part of a spree because you have 3 or more victims in 2 or more locations. It's just that he's so well known for the 69 murders that happened on the island, and that most of them were children. So it's really horrific. But most people would say he's a mass murderer, and he is. But in reality, he really fits into the spree category. And that's the problem, is that, you know, originally sprees overlap serial and they overlap mass murder, and it became confusing for people. And I think what Catherine and I are trying to do in this is to actually define it so that it's separate and distinct from serial and from mass, and then to develop categories, which we have some are work to be proactive for law enforcement, and others of the category don't work. You aren't going to be able to utilize the techniques and the things that we talk about for some of these categories.
So now, what were some of the most unique cases you've dealt with in the serial killer world?
I've dealt with serial murder cases around the world, because of course the FBI has an international presence through our legal attaché. So we get requests. When I was in the unit, we got requests from all over. Of course, most of our cases come from within the U.S., but I would say the Robert Yates case, for me, the Spokane serial murder case, was one of the bigger cases that I worked on. It was a case that I not only worked on when it was unsolved, but also after it was solved and then testified as an expert witness for the Pierce County Prosecutor's Office for two of the homicides that Robert Yates had committed. But the Rodney Alcala case that I've worked on for New York District Attorney's Office, and sometimes these cases weren't actually my case, but I would travel with a colleague, you know, to work on a serial case, the Baton Rouge serial killer, Derek Todd Lee. I was down there. We developed a very good strategy for identifying Lee. So some of the cases I've had, I've worked on and then actually testified in those cases, and others I've worked on, but they're all, there's no case that we would get in the unit that wasn't really a high-profile case. If it's coming into the behavioral analysis unit, especially if it's a serial murder case, then it's garnered a lot of national attention.
What's your thought on these high-profile cases being televised during the whole court?
I think that's
process.
Fine. I don't have a problem with any of that. They're oftentimes multi-week or multi-month trials, so for someone to actually sit through that. But it's an educational process, I think, for people who watch it. One of the areas that that we've had to dispel, especially I noticed this, especially testifying as expert on the stand, is this is called the CSI effect. You know, the time frame that actual forensics and what we can actually do with fingerprints and DNA sometimes on television is unrealistic, and juries who watch a lot of television have an unrealistic expectation of what we can do with forensic evidence in the lab. And sometimes testifying is basically a way to educate the jury as to what we can and, you know, the limitations of certain types of forensic analysis, along with, you know, because when I'm testifying, I'm incorporating my analysis of the forensic evidence, the physical evidence, whether that was tested or not, and the behavioral evidence, integrating those together. So I have to talk to the physical evidence and the forensic evidence as an integral part of the overall whole, along with the behavioral dynamics in a scene, and sometimes educating the juries about, you know, the limitations of what, you know, what's really realistic in terms of getting fingerprints or, you know, touch DNA or, you know, whatever expectation they might have about certain types of evidence. I think that's it. Yeah, I think it's not only educating them about the particular crime, but also about, you know, what is really realistic in the real world, the real forensic world, as opposed to the forensic world on a television show.
Yeah, quite a difference. I don't know, I was just wondering if social media, or if you think that things being televised, because if you know, some people get really put under scrutiny by so many others just outside of it. They might not like you, or they don't like your
absolutely.
Hair or your tie. Look at Marcia Clark and all that. I just wonder if
well,
that really
I guess it just depends on how much media attention it gets. You know, the there's not very many high profile trials that are televised, but all of the information is, you know, being vetted through a judge, through the prosecutor and defense attorneys, as to what can come in legally, what can't, what's heard outside the presence of the jury. And then, of course, these are decisions all made by the jury. So, you know, I don't know that it affects, it certainly would affect the people within the trial, but I don't know that it affects the outcome of the trial. And that would be my bigger concern about televising something.
Wow, it's interesting. What do you?
It's more, you know, the book is really a textbook. I think one of the advantages of the book is that every case in the 419 cases all have a summary, and they come from 43 countries. So there's quite an international component. It's more of a text and reference guide. So if you read it, what you start to understand is how these categories were comprised, how we developed them, what they mean, what you can do with them, and what you can't. So I think that's the key. Law enforcement can use it as a reference guide, and I think that was part of what we were trying to do. But also, I think the most important aspect to take away is that there is a really well-defined type of murder that is a spree killing, and that we can and have developed categories, much like we have for serial murder, much like we have for mass murder. And unlike serial and unlike mass murder, there are several of those categories that where law enforcement can be proactive, and we share those cases in the book where law enforcement has recognized, you know, we need to get on the social media aspect of our victims, potentially if we know who the offender is in their social media aspects, or potential suspects, and utilize that information in order to be able to move forward in identifying the offender or potential victims, so that we can make them aware, warn them that they need to either move or make themselves safe. And that's very real. That's a proactive way to save lives by intercepting this case if you recognize what you're dealing with. And that is not something that we really can do in serial murder or in mass murder, but we can do it in spree murders. And this book basically tells you these are the types of categories where you can do it, and these are the categories where you can't. And then, how do you do it? What should you be focusing on? How do you determine which category your homicides are falling into? So that's, I think, the crux of the book. And it really is the first work that's been done on, serious work that's been done on spree murders with an exceptionally large database that we're still updating. I mean, I think I've gathered at least another 25 cases, some very recent cases, that we will eventually incorporate into a second edition. So we'll always be adding to this case list and increasing our totals, and hopefully that will give us I think it will spur also more research within the criminology field to do more research on spree murders. And you know, our argument is the FBI did away with that category in 2005, but we think for some killers that is a valid category and it should be brought back. That's our argument. We should bring, the FBI should bring spree killers back, that multicide category, and then utilize the categories that we've put together.
And when you say international component, do you find that spree killers and even serial killers in other countries have a different different format or way that they kill? And do the police take a different...
Because there's so much a real diversity in the types of cases that we have internationally. So we have 43 countries, and some of those are very poor countries, some of those are Western countries. So it's difficult to compare all of the international cases, but I think some of the overall generalities for most of our offenders, they follow along with what we found in the United States in terms of being male offenders, mostly white offenders. I think the weapons used internationally change from the U.S. Internationally, we find the use a greater use of edged weapons as opposed to guns in this country. But on other areas, it's difficult to compare a particular country to the U.S. or the countries that we've looked at to other countries, just because there's such a diverse range of economic success and culture and population. But I think generally the topics across the board, male offenders, Caucasian offenders, still holds true internationally. Weapons change, whether they're traveling from the scene in a vehicle or on foot, that changes. But overall, I would say a pretty homogeneous group of offenders in the major categories or in the major aspects of these killers that we looked at around the globe. And we're still trying to gather, we'd like to get, we know there are spree killers in every country. It's just that we didn't have really the resources to make contacts in every country. We utilized our resources. I utilized my international resource contacts around the world to get cases in a number of countries. But we know that these killers exist everywhere. We would really like to get more international spree killer cases, and perhaps if we have more, then we can actually make a comparison among countries in Africa or in South America. So maybe there's, with more of those cases, we could make some comparisons. But right now, I don't think would be a fair comparison to look at the international component just by itself.
Okay. Well, now
I have my website, fbsinternational.com. That's like Forensic Behavioral Services International, FBS.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay, we'll have that up on our website along with your book, so people listening can do one click and pick up the book. Again, thank you very much for taking the
time.
Thanks
very much, Alan. I appreciate it. And I hope your listeners found it interesting.
Thanks so much, Mark.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.